Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. So today I'm here with James Wetler, founder of Cabrito in the UK and author of the book Goat, Cooking and Eating. James, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be on the Heritage Radio Network.
Amazing. And you came from...
We flew from London on Monday night. It all gets a bit sort of fuzzy when you fly overnight. Yesterday was the first sort of full day in New York. But I've been before. So I came over to meet all the guys from Heritage Foods, Patrick and Emily and stuff, in March, just to talk about Coatober and how we could work together.
Right.
And there was obviously some result there, because here I am back again for it.
Amazing. Yeah, and we're going to be talking about raising and eating goats, because you mentioned this month is Goat-tober.
Yeah.
And somewhat coincidentally, not quite coincidentally, but it's an initiative that was started by the last host of this show, The Farm Report, Aaron Fairbanks.
Yeah.
So it all comes full circle. So I have lots of questions about goats and what you do. Let's start with the most important question, which is, why are goats so ridiculously cute?
I don't know. So their mothers love when they're born, I guess. I've got no idea.
You sent me the picture for the episode of you holding the goat, and I was my God.
Well, that maybe doesn't, when you're talking about goat meat, that's maybe not a great place to start.
True, yeah.
I think that there is something in, sort of more broadly, they are amazing animals. I mean, generally, they're really smart, they're incredibly useful, and they have played a really important role in human development in terms of farming since they were first domesticated in the mountains of northern Iran in 11,000 BC. And I think that is something that has been overlooked by society generally. We don't really think of goats as playing a big part in sort of agricultural mix, because we're so used to sheep and cows and pigs and chickens and stuff. Mm-hmm. But goats' partnership with humans is really fundamental. And I think that that's the stuff that sort of I like to talk about in the attempt, and basically what I'm doing is rebranding goats, because they do have this bad reputation. There's a lot that it's a really, goats and humans is a really fascinating story.
Oh, so how did you get interested in that story?
There was no grand plan. I mean, we didn't get into goats because we sat down and wrote a business study and thought, like, well, business plan, and thought, what is the gap in the market? Mm-hmm. My partner and I, Sushi, my partner in both business and life, we have two kids and stuff, we moved back to Devon, where I grew up, which is a sort of a county in the southwest of England, quite rural.
Okay.
After I'd been a chef in London for 12 years. And we were sort of lent this little area of land, about the size of a baseball pitch. And it was some friends of ours, but it was really overrun. So we were going to get some pigs and put some pigs on it.
Mm.
But the next door neighbours didn't want us to have pigs, so we ended up with four goats. So we went to a local cheese producer who was producing on quite a small scale. Mm-hmm. He had like 120 goats.
Okay.
And we bought four off him, put them on this piece of land. And in that time we had them, over the 6 month period when we fattened them, I learnt about the billy goat problem, in inverted commas. The idea that the dairy system doesn't have any use for these excess males. I'd been a chef previously in London for 12 years. I was cooking in Axminster in Devon at the time. When the goats were ready to be, when they'd done their job clearing this piece of land, I put them on the menu in the restaurant I was working in. They sold really well.
Mm.
And I had this kind of light bulb moment and thought, I know that Will, the farmer who we'd bought these goats from, had these probably 70 or 80 billies he wanted to get rid of. I was working in a restaurant and I had access to this London restaurant market because I'd worked in it and I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe I could solve Will's problem. Maybe I could pay for a holiday, you know, and just mm-hmm. have a bit of extra cash and do this little thing on the side while I carried on cooking. But within 18 months, I'd quit cooking full time and I was selling goats. Yeah. And we became more involved in... In Europe, there are the sort of goats dairy sector is much more commercial in terms of its sort of operational design.
Okay.
Like, so as I understand it, in the sort of upstate area in New York and sort of the New England area where you produce cheese here, they're mm-hmm. much more small scale farms, maybe 150, 200 nanny goats and on farm production. In the UK, it's much more like dairy production is. So you have rotary parlors, 2000 nanny goats, you know, it's okay. a much more mechanized, industrialized system. So that means that there's 100,000 milking nannies in the UK, and that is in a dairy system, a dairy system of production that are producing lots of liquid milk. 2,000 nanny goats on a farm means there's 2,000 billy goats without a future. You know, is with a pretty grim prognosis. They're being shot, basically.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you that. So you sort of mentioned this problem, but can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah.
The goats that are actually used for dairy are giving birth to goats that are then male, and then there's no use for them, correct?
I think I've seen on YouTube Erin yeah. Fairbanks describe mm-hmm. it as, we all understand basic biology,
right,
and yet we don't make the connection between lactation, pregnancy, right, and birth.
Yeah.
You know, so in order to create lactation from a man, when you need pregnancy, we all understand the consequences of pregnancy being offspring.
Mm-hmm.
Nature dictates there's a 50-50 split between males and females. A dairy industry doesn't have any use for males. In theory, you only need one. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that because they work on genetics. But if you have a dairy system with 2,500 nanny goats in that system, you probably only need six billy goats in order to service those females,
okay,
to create the lactation. So in an overwhelming majority of cases, the nanny goats will have two kids, boy, girl, 4,000 kids, 2,000 males. 2,000 males you don't need.
Okay.
And there is, given that there's no market in the US or no market in Europe for male billy goats, in an overwhelming number of cases, they were shot.
They're shot, and then what's...
Feedlots, maybe, mm-hmm. or burnt.
Wow.
But not going into the food system.
Right.
And when you're talking about this... it's quite easy just to point the fingers at the farmers and say, this is your fault because you're the one euthanizing them.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the right way to think about it. You know, as consumers, we're responsible for that as well. And mm-hmm. retailers are responsible for that as well. So it's not that one particular person is responsible. Everybody's responsible for the food system that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have, so if you think about it in terms of, the farmers don't want to rear those animals because you can't expect a farmer to rear an animal that doesn't have a market for.
Right.
You know, he's going to end up putting $100 into the rearing of that animal, and then he's not going to be able to sell it. So there's $100 down the drain.
Yeah.
Retailers who are selling on the cheese, they don't want to think, well, actually you should be buying these goats as well, because at the moment they're getting shot, because retailers don't want that kind of reputation attached to those products or to their brand. And us as retailers, we're just happy eating our cheese and not thinking about where it comes from.
Mm.
And what we try and say when we're trying to sell goat meat to people is say, and I think this is something that is not just applicable to goat meat. There are consequences to your purchasing decisions. You walk into a deli and you buy a piece of goat's cheese. Somewhere down the line, the consequence of that purchase is a dairy system that's shooting perfectly healthy billy goats.
Mm-hmm.
You can offset that by saying, well, instead of every time I go to the store, I'm going to buy some lamb or some beef or some pork for my meat protein, I'll buy some goat. And that will offset that purchase decision a little bit. And it will make the dairy system more sustainable, but crucially, not just sustainable in an environmental sense, which is obviously really important.
Right.
It will make it more sustainable in a financial sense as
well. Right, because you're paying the farmer, you're providing a source of income, right?
We put 20% on the turnovers of the farms where we buy everything.
Wow.
There are a tax savings of that. They're buying their feed and their straw, and they're buying everything in larger quantities, which means they get a better price for it. Mm-hmm. So the whole system becomes more sustainable. And it also shows that these goats are producing dual purpose animals. As you know, dual purpose animals is the holy grail in farming. You want it to produce milk and good meat. And these goats do that. And it's just been, it has suited everyone to think of goats as an inferior quality product, because that kind of gives you a bit of a pass for not rearing them, you know. And talking about it now, you know, I've been doing this for 6 years, and I still can't get past the idea that we allowed a system to be built up that was predicated on the idea of 50% of the offspring born on the farm would be shot and burnt, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just insane that sort of is even allowed. And it also struck me as just being really stupid. You know, it's just a really stupid thing to do. And that, I think that was kind of the motivation behind it. We felt like this is so dumb that there is a solution out here. None of it feels sort of unachievable.
Right. So you mentioned these farms where, you know, you might be buying 2,000 goats. What's the scale of your business now? Like, how many goats are you buying a year? Or like, I'm curious.
Well, in the UK there's 100,000 milking nannies.
Okay.
50% of those are in the sort of commercial sector, so they're on larger farms, up to 2,500 milking nannies on a farm. We work with a company called Delamere, and Delamere is going to get quite complicated now. Delamere are half of that commercial sector, so they have about 25,000 goats in their system, and we buy about 60-65% of all the billy goats that they produce. So we're selling anywhere between 40 and 60 goats a week. And we have a number of outlets. We have a shop on the website. And we also have, well, the majority of our business is direct to restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a long way to go. I mean, for me, it feels like we take maybe 20-25% nationally of all the billy goats born in the UK.
Okay.
And that feels like hopefully the hardest 20-25%. You know, getting it from 0 to 20%, you'd think it would be easier to get it from 20 to 40. And then, and the goal is, I mean, Cabrito is a very simple business, and it has a one-line mission statement of all the billy goats in the dairy system into the food, all the billy goats in the dairy system into the food system.
Mm.
You know, and that's the one line. And that's kind of that's the goal, you know. And we've had, the success that we've had has been driven by sort of the collaboration between farmers, me as the supplier and as the middleman, and then restaurants, and using the restaurants to showcase, you know, the thing about restaurants. Like, we've got this tonight, we've got this dinner at Claro in Brooklyn with TJ Steele. Basically, chefs pay me to buy my product, and then they make it look as good and taste as good as possible. And that's what TJ is going to do tonight. Mm. So if I can start talking to someone and say, my product is delicious. They can walk into Claro and have TJ cook it, and they can taste and see it's delicious. And that is such a handy tool for suppliers. And I think there's a really interesting interface there between problems in the food system, suppliers that are trying to fix it, and using chefs as as ambassadors for your product, and therefore a more sustainable food industry. And I think that's kind of a model that can work really well.
Right. And part of this model is, you talk a lot about eliminating waste, right? Which is huge, part of what you're doing. In terms of the animal itself, like, how much of a goat are you able to use? So, you know, it's like we talk about utilizing a whole animal. Like, I have no idea when it comes to goats, like, Can you only use meat from one part of the animal?
No. I mean, it's so fascinating. There are so many misconceptions around this animal that was the first ever domesticated farm animal. You know, it's like goat is shrouded in mystery for some reason, it's quite obscure, and that doesn't. So a good rule of thumb is anything you can do with a lamb, you can do with a goat.
Okay.
So they are essentially the advantage, or one of the things that lambs don't look like lambs did 3,000 years ago. You know, lambs have been altered into meat animals by years and years of selective breeding. So lambs have these big legs, big back ends. They have big, large shoulders, and goats don't have that. Goats are much more sort of wild. They have not been manipulated by humans for meat animals. All the work on genetics in terms of improving the animal as a farm animal has been done on the dairy side. Okay. So talking about yields and making animals better at producing more milk, it's never been done on the meat side. Whereas in pigs and something the heritage talk a lot about is genetic work in animals. So the improvements in terms of yields and the improvements in the animals from a farming perspective has all been done on the dairy side.
Okay.
So, I mean, the book's got 70 recipes in it, and it's got everything from burgers and pasta sauces through to roasted legs and smoked and braised shoulders. So there isn't, in food terms, it is as versatile as lambs. I think the advantage that goat has is that it spans so many cuisines.
Mm.
So it is a truly global food. So if you, and one of the things that we talk about talking to people that have never cooked goat before, I'm like, well, the thing about it is it will expand your home cooking repertoire, because it will force you to go and find something you've probably never cooked before.
Mm.
And that's a really exciting thing to do. But that said, it goes in burgers and pasta sauces. So you can make it with things you are familiar with as well. So it's a really, once you get over the fact that it's something you're not used to eating, it's actually really accessible. There isn't anything about it that requires any different skills than anything else that you cook.
Right. So did you have to do a lot of education about that with people in the UK? I mean, I feel like in the US.
Well, I had to learn myself first.
Right. You
know? 6 years ago, when I first started doing this, I didn't have any more knowledge than the next person about goats. So it was only, I mean, I was lucky because I have a chef background, so I'm used to working with food. I'm a half decent butcher. I can cut up an animal. So it was that sort of, you know, a rabbit. The structure of rabbit for butchery is pretty much the same as, you know, they just get bigger. The animals just get bigger all the way up to a cow. So if you can butcher a leg of a rabbit, you can pretty much butcher the leg of a goat. So it wasn't, I never found it really alien, but I just, it's a cultural thing. I mean, we don't have any history of eating goat in the UK. We don't have it in Western society more generally. We don't have a history of, especially Northwest Europe and sort of the US, we don't have a history of eating them. And that is the thing that has, I often say, you know, we started a business with no product because the animals didn't exist, because they're all being euthanized, no market because no one ate meat coats, and 900 years of cultural history against us, and yet we still went into business. So it was, you know, it was probably not a wise decision, but it's turned out all right in the end.
Yeah. Do people come into eating goat with like misconceptions about it too, or a specific idea about what the meat is like?
It's unbelievable. I mean, there are people even, quite often I get, because we have this shop on the website, and quite often people email me and say how the animal slaughtered, because they assume that there must be some sort of ritual slaughter because they have this association with halal food. And it's like, I can kind of understand it, but it just shows the sort of mystery that shrouds goats. They have to be killed in a certain way. Of course they don't. They're slaughtered in slaughterhouses like under EU regulations, like all the other animals in the UK. So yeah, they do. And people have this, essentially people think that goats are, you know, second rate animals that are tied to a fence post with a piece of string that eat plastic and people's hats and, you know, that right. And they're not, you know, they're scrawny and smelly and all those things. And that's a really adhesive idea. You know, it's hard to break away from that. So one of the things that we talk about a lot is that these are well-reared, well-farmed, sort of really healthy, well-reared animals that deserve a place in the food system, you know. And like I said, it's kind of suited everyone for them not to have that, because then it makes it kind of easier to justify their slaughter because they're not very good animals, you know. But that just isn't true. Mm. So Yeah, I think in writing the book, we tried to, you know, there's the history of humans and goats, which contextualizes everything. But then the selection of recipes, you've got stuff that people are really familiar with, plus stuff that people aren't so familiar with. You know, just to show that sort of, as I said before, the sort of the cross-cultured nature of it, mm-hmm. and its sort of global reach. But one of the things I like cooking most out of the book is the kibbeh nya, which is like a raw sort of Middle Eastern version of tartare, because it's a raw goat product. And people assume the goat is tough. They assume it's gamey. They assume it needs a lot of cooking. They assume that it's going to be really flat, like really strong in flavor. And kibbeh, which is raw chopped goat, and you keep pounding it with a knife until you get that kind of pastiness in the raw meat. And then you mix it with 50-50 bulgur wheat and then loads of lemon, loads of soft herbs like mint and chives and parsley and tarragon and dill. And then that's it. Mm. It's this like pile of raw meat and bulgur, and people try it, and it's the exact opposite of what they were expecting. Hmm. First of all, it's raw, so it doesn't require any real cooking to get that toughness out of it.
Right.
And it's got a real, because they're quite young animals, they have a sweetness to them and a kind of really light musky tone and a kind of light ironiness that you get in raw meat. It's the most effective way of changing people's minds.
Interesting.
Just say, try this, because it's not what you expect.
Right.
So that's kind of a shortcut way of taking a recipe and showing people it's not what they expect. But at the same time, that if you want people to, if you're trying to create a bridge for people to get into goat, then there's three curry recipes in the book, because that's what people are familiar with.
And I think how I immediately, when I was like thinking, when have I had goat? I'm like, oh, in goat curry.
Yeah, sure. And it is an advantage for goat that it is known as that sort of Caribbean curry goat, mm-hmm. is a world food. Everybody's aware of it. That is a blessing and a curse, because everybody associates it with one dish. Makes it quite hard to get them to think about it in another way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, at least it's part of the conversation about food.
Right. You know? So we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the relationship you mentioned between humans and goats and sort of the role that goats play in pharmacology.
Yeah. it's fascinating.
Yeah. So we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio. I'm here with James Wetler, and we are talking about goats today.
Yes, so, my specialized subject.
Yeah, we got through a lot before the break. I want to talk a little bit about more about farming, considering the show, right?
Sure.
We started talking about eating a lot, I think, just because, you know, you get excited.
Yeah, totally.
But in preparing for this episode, I did a little bit of reading about raising goats. And, I was reading this one article that was sort of talking about how goat meat is inherently potentially more sustainable than other meats.
Yeah.
And part of the argument is that goats play this sort of important role in a farm's ecology.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what is that role? I think you started to kind of hint at it earlier in the episode.
Well, I mean, that isn't I would say that isn't the case in the European system, because the European systems are set. I mean, they're all housed in the European system, so they're not free range. They're all indoors, and they are dairy units. So, in terms of in a sort of small holding area, then yes, I mean they would play a role in land management. Essentially, I mean they are the most efficient hoovers, you know, and they're really good at that. And but that isn't the system that we work in the US. And in the UK, sorry. And one of the things that really was a sort of a moral decision for us to make right at the beginning was, and I say this in the book, I'm emotionally a free ranger. You know, I believe that animals should be kept outside. Did we want to be involved in a system that had entirely housed animals? And the answer to that was, well, we can either be involved in that system and try and do something about the bigger problem, which is the euthanizing of the billies at birth, or we can ignore it and hope that it goes away. And I've always felt it's better to be involved and try and make positive change from the inside than just down on the outside throwing tomatoes at it. You know what I mean? It's just...
Right.
And so the role that they play on a more traditional farm is very different, obviously, than a dairy that is just about producing liquid milk.
Right. So are there not a lot of farms that are actually raising goats for meat in the UK at all?
There are, but they're on a much smaller scale. Mm. So there will be they will be small farms that are producing sort of for mail order. The thing about it though is that the economics of the whole system don't really work unless the dairy is involved. So the animals that are being raised just for meat aren't any cheaper than the animals that are on a dairy system, because you have these economics of scale, as I said before, about these larger group, these larger dairies. But also, because the things that hold back a sort of just a single meat production are weight of carcass at slaughter. So weight is money in farming. So a billy goat will be maybe 20 kilos, 22 kilos. They'll only have two kids normally, and you have to house the nanny goats all year round. So, and all of that cost falls on these billy goats and that doesn't really work in terms of that. So animals that are reared just for meat, goats are just reared for meat, are as expensive as the one that comes in the dairy system. So there isn't any advantage really. And there isn't really any advantage to keeping them just as meat animals. So, and it doesn't address the problem of the knocking the billies on the head. You know, and in terms of scale, if you want to make a sustainable business, you have to have a certain number of products to sell. The dairy system offers you that because these animals are being born anyway.
Right.
So in order to make a sort of nationwide, almost to get into those sort of larger distribution networks, you need to access the dairy market, because no one's going to keep 100,000 meat goats, but there are 100,000 milk goats.
Right.
It is there.
But so theoretically, if you had a dairy that was grass fed, I mean, you could you could technically source the billies from a farm like that, and
this is where it becomes problematic.
Okay.
In terms of the ethics of those kind of dairies. So, as I said before, I'm an emotional free ranger. When we were talking about researching the book, when I was researching the book, I felt like I needed to explain why the animals are kept indoors all the time. So I did an interview with a Dutch small ruminant specialist, a vet called Marguerite Groensveld, and she said, if you're keeping animals on any sort of scale, you need to goats specifically. This isn't applicable to any other farm animal, but with goats, because of their complex digestive systems and because of their weak feet, from an animal welfare point of view, if you're keeping goats on any type of scale, you need to keep them indoors. So I'll explain why now.
Okay.
First of all, it's managing the feed. So goats have a really, really complex stomach system, which is governed by the rumen. And 9 times out of 10, if there's something wrong with a goat, it's the rumen. So in order to manage what they eat, because they can't, contrary to what people believe, goats can't just survive on anything. They're actually really fussy eaters. So in order to manage the animal's health, you need to manage its diet. They also don't have any natural protections to the sort of parasites that live in damp grass and ground that you get in the UK. So cows and sheep, which are indigenous animals, have thousands of years of building up a resistance to these flukes and to these parasites. You put goats onto those and they don't have those resistance, it'll make the goats unwell. The other thing is that their feet designed for dry, arid climates, and obviously in the UK it's very damp ground. So you would have a lot, in short, you would have more vet intervention if you kept them outside than if you kept them inside.
Okay.
Now, there's a big difference between an animal being sick and an animal losing production. Animal doesn't have to be showing outward signs of being ill in order to lose 10-15% of its milk production. That 10-15% over 2,000-2,500 nannies is a big impact on the viability of that farm in terms of its milk sales. So in order to make those farms, from an animal welfare point of view, leading to less vet intervention, and from the financial success point of view of the dairy industry, they need to be kept indoors. And that's a really hard pill for me to swallow. But we interviewed one of the Europe's leading small ruminant specialists, and that was what she said. So I'm not arrogant enough to think that I know better than someone that has dedicated their whole life to the well-being of these animals. It's still quite difficult for me to swallow.
Right. And so then what do they actually eat?
So they have like a ground... Sorry, I just want to... they have like a ground nut, like a pig nut or a calf wiener pellet, which will have everything they need in terms of their nutrition. And that will be an ad lib feed for the kids. That will be an ad lib feed. And they also have straw and hay, which will also be ad lib. The nanny goats have ad lib straw and hay, but they have a ration. So every time they go on the rotary milk parlour, the amount of food they need drops in front of them. So their diets are really well managed. And that also has an implication for the consistency of the milk. So one of the things when the UK goat dairy first got going, they found that they had a really fluctuating quality product. So in order to manage the quality of that milk product, they manage the consistency of the feed. So it is a complex argument, and it's difficult for me to accept that if you are to keep these animals on a large scale, they need to be kept indoors. That raises the question, do we need to go dairy industry? And right. that is a valid argument to have, but that isn't the world that we live in. And the dairy system at the moment exists, and it is going strong in the UK. There's 350,000 milking nannies in Holland. There's 1 million milking nannies in France. Those industries aren't going away anytime soon. And the bigger problem, I think, other than the indoor nature and the animal welfare nature of and the animal welfare argument surrounding the housed goats, the biggest problem in that industry for me is knocking the billy goats on the head and chucking them in the bin as soon as they're born. So I work within that system trying to solve one of the wrongs rather than say I'm not going to get involved in it because I don't agree with it.
Right. So do you find that hard in terms of selling the meat that you sell? Do people want to know, you know, like where is this coming from? What it, you know, I don't even know what the right terms are when it comes to goat, right? Like you want it to be free range, grass fed, organic. I feel like everybody wants to know. So is that a challenge to explain? Like
yes.
Everything you just said, it was really fascinating, but you can't put all that on a menu or a label, right? Like that would be...
Yeah, but what you can say is that if we don't eat these, they get shot and put in the bin.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things, goat has this great story, not just the, you know, the history of humans and goats and all that stuff is fascinating, and the amazing cheese they produce and, you know, the sort of general utility of these animals is pretty amazing. But it has a really, in terms of... food sustainability message, you can understand it in one sentence. You know, these animals are being shot, euthanized. That's really stupid. Let's rear them up for meat and eat them, you know?
Right.
And we can talk about that all day long, you know, and we can talk about the ethics of all that, and we can talk about the good story behind goat, and we can talk about, you know, the husbandry and what we've done in terms of its ethical message. All of that doesn't mean anything if it doesn't taste good,
right?
You know, because you're not going to be able to sell it if it doesn't taste good.
It's funny. Like I totally agree with you. And now my mind is just like really running. Cause you're bringing up so many interesting.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the thing about the goat industry, it's a great snapshot of the sort of food system that we have, you know,
it, right.
a lot of the issues in the wider food system are sort of coalesced around goats. There is a dairy system. Should we have a dairy system? There is housed animals. Should we have housed animals? There is waste in the system because we're euthanizing the bit. There's a lot of things that force itself in this little sort of goat question, which makes it really interesting to talk about.
Right. Well, and I guess where my mind went is you're sort of brilliantly solving this one issue and this one like ethical problem, which is that these goats are being shot in the head and it's waste and you're creating a food source from that. But in a strange way, you're almost like helping industrial farms solve a problem that they created that's part of a system that you're saying you're not even sure you believe in.
Well, here's the thing about the UK, and I can only speak with any authority about the UK.
Yeah.
The UK dairy industry is 20, 25 years old, right? So it's run by a load of people that have chosen to be part of the dairy system. Mm-hmm. They're an almost self-selecting bunch of forward-thinking farmers because they've looked at what they've got and they've looked at changing trends and thought, goat is the next big thing. I'm going to get into that. Mm. And they have chosen to be in it, which means things in the dairy industry aren't done like dad used to do it and his dad used to do it, and they're not stuck in their ways in that kind of... in the way that it is produced. They're always looking for improvements. Mm. So, and one of the ways that that manifests itself is the selective breeding they use to increase the yields of the goats, the milk yield. And they're not doing that based on just trying to produce goats of bigger and bigger udders. They're trying to produce goats that are stronger and less susceptible to disease. And the thing that does is like the average milking yield from a goat is anywhere between 600 and 800 litres a year. Mm-hmm. Through selective breeding and the genetic work of selective breeding, which in this case is only speeding up what's been done for years in terms of selective breeding, you can do it through genetics. And instead of having to rear the animal over 3 years and keep its records of its milk production and then compare it to the old ones to see if you've got a better animal, you can take a blood test and see as soon as it's born. Mm. That will increase the yield from the farm. You can essentially double your production without increasing your carbon inputs. Mm. So your farm becomes more efficient in terms of its impact. So it is really, really complex. Mm. But again, the sort of focus of Cabrito is pretty lasered at all of that stuff. I am generally interested in that stuff, you know, and I think it's fascinating and brilliant to discuss. And as I said, it's a microcosm of some of the problems in farming more generally. Mm. But Cabrito's focus is, yeah, all that's out there and I won't be able to solve all of that, but I can solve this problem. So I'm going to get involved in this problem. And you're right. There are elements of it that I find challenging. But in the end, you come back to, well, these animals should be going into the food system.
Right.
Like so you do have to balance those things out. And that's, you know, you have to do that in life with a lot of things.
Right. Absolutely. And is there... are you seeing this happening anywhere else other than in the UK? Like, are you working with other people who have similar models in other places?
Yeah, we are. Like I said, there's a million billy goats being slaughtered every year in France. I mean, it's a huge number, almost like you can't get your head around that number, you know? And especially when you think, well, I've got to try and do something about that. Am I really going to be able to sell a million billy goats in France? Who knows? But there is, we have been working on a project called the Food Heroes Project, which is part funded by the EU and part funded by a farming organization and it wasn't just about goats. It was focused on waste in farming more generally. So they did things about the male chickens. They also do things about wonky veg and that kind of stuff, trying to find markets. And they also did bycatch in fish. So it was a project focused on food waste more generally, but they came to us because they had seen that we had some success in the UK, and now we're working with the Food Heroes Project in France and in Germany France, Germany and the Netherlands. So we've got a pilot project running in the Netherlands. That each system is different. As I said before, we have this sort of large industrial side, like commercial side, and so does Holland. And in Germany, it's much more like the small farmers making cheese on the farm as it is here. And in France, obviously, it's this massive juggernaut of a thing. Mm. There's some problems in terms of rearing the animals that we've solved in the UK. And again, each sort of territory is different. But we castrate the animals as soon as they're born in the UK, which means the meat never gets tainted. Mm. So an animal will get from birth to slaughter in sort of 6 months, hence, you know, they're born in March and Goat-toper is when Goat-toper is, because it's 6 months later. If you don't castrate the animals, you're up against the clock. There will be a point at which they'll become mature and the meat will get tainted. So that's...
What do you mean by tainted?
The male hormone, they will start to smell, and that... So smelly goat, they do become quite smelly when they're sexually mature.
Okay.
And that also taints the meat. So if you castrate them, you remove that. You're not up against that clock.
Okay.
It also allows you to, because you know that I don't have to sell them within 6 months, otherwise they're tainted, you can extend them beyond sort of to 8 months, and you get slightly heavier carcasses more generally, which make them more profitable for us.
Mm.
They also make them a better product in terms of what chefs and consumers want out of them. That they become a little bit more, the meat to bone ratio becomes better.
Mm.
And it also gives the farmer a little bit of leeway, because he thinks, okay, well, if they're not castrated, I have to sell them by the time they're 6 months old. If they're not, I've got an extra 2 months to sell them. So it gives them a little bit of security, and that has allowed us to... So when we first started, we were starting selling like 100 a year.
Mm.
And then the next year we sold 500, then we sold 1,000. Farmers felt like they could keep more alive because they knew that they had this, they didn't have a definite time they had to sell them.
Mm.
Anywhere between 6 and 9 months we can sell them now. And you can manage their weight by pulling them off the intensive for the hard feed, keep them on straw and hay. They won't lose and sort of ease out the ad lib feed, and you can manage their weights, their slaughter weights, much better. You can't do that if you castrate them, because they're definitely going to get tainted at around 6 months. So that was how it worked in the Netherlands.
Okay.
And they had some... Well, the farmers were quite anti-castrating them because they thought it was... I don't understand it. You know, people do it to their dogs and cats and don't think twice about it. So we've now persuaded some of the farms to run trial projects based on our rearing plan.
Okay.
Which means you've got a better quality animal, a better quality finished meat animal, which is more attractive to butchers and to chefs.
Chefs.
So that's kind of that model is kind of what we're exporting. So we're working in Holland and we're working in France with that. But it's a huge challenge.
Yeah. What about in the US? I mean, I know that's not your expertise, but I mean, do we even, I don't know anything about goat dairies in the US. Like, do we even have a lot of goat dairy happening here?
Yeah, well, the Goat-toper was started by Erin because obviously Anne Taxelby was working with those farmers up. I mean, I was in Chelsea Market yesterday and ate my way through about 5 plates of cheese.
Mm.
All that stuff comes from the New England area.
Right.
So there are smaller...
They're just small.
Yeah. small scale producing on-farm cheese, so farmhouse cheese making, mm-hmm. where you've got the herd and the sort of concentrating on the terroir of the region and the input that has into the cheese flavours, all that kind of stuff. Obviously, because France is this big juggernaut of goat's cheese, it has a much more... I mean, France probably got the most sophisticated industrial farming system in the world.
Mm.
And obviously in that, there is the goat system.
Right.
So they're very different models. And which is one of the challenges of what we're doing. So we're trying to adapt, the success that we've had in the UK, trying to replicate that through these different territories with their different systems. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing, you know, but they all have the same goal, that all of these... Everybody knows we can't do this, you know, and everybody knows it needs to be stopped. And the way to do that is, I think, the way that we have kind of shown.
Right. Well, that's a great note to end on. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And if you want to check out James' book, it's called Goat, Cooking and Eating. That's right?
Yeah, that is.
And actually, for anyone who's listening who is in New York, do you want to mention, are there any events that people can go to related to Goat-toper?
Yeah, tonight in Brooklyn at Claro.
Okay.
TJ's cooking on a couple of big green eggs that we've got for the smoking the goats, making some tacos and some tostadas. And then tomorrow we're in the East Village at Hurtas. We're doing some goat pinchos and a few bits, and I'm going to be there talking about all this stuff all over again, because it's what I do.
Perfect. Thanks again.
Brilliant.
Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe, rate, and share it. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.